from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a possible shift in U.S.-Afghan relations. A new Brookings report on ISIS use of social media.
They use it for a variety of purposes. The most visible one is to spread their propaganda. They have a lot of content, video and audio, texts that they want to send out to the widest possible audience.
What is being called Egypt's systematic campaign against civil society and food and water shortages in cyclone-hit Vanuatu. I'm Susan Yawkey. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is scheduled to address a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today, with the White House saying his speech will be an opportunity to mark a new chapter in U.S.-Afghan relations after years of strain under his predecessor, Hamid Karzai. Tuesday, during a joint news conference at the White House, President Obama announced a delayed withdrawal of more than 5,000 of the 9,800 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Mr. Obama said the Afghan leader requested some flexibility on the drawdown timeline, while Mr. Obama's national security team urged him to maintain the current force posture through this year. Ankit Panda, editor of The Diplomat and Asia-Pacific International Current Affairs publication, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the decision is a tribute to Mr. Ghani's determination to improve bilateral relations.
It's a huge move, and I think it just speaks to the success on the part of the Afghan president and the current government. It's a complete sea change from Ashraf Ghani's predecessor, Hamid Karzai. Last year, before the Afghan elections, relations between the United States and the Afghan government were, to put it mildly, terrible. You had Hamid Karzai, who had accused the U.S. government of collusion with the Taliban. And if there's a single mission that Ashraf Ghani has had since coming to power, vis-a-vis bilateral relations with the United States, it's been to show the White House and show President Obama that he is someone the United States can work with in the long term.
How much of a factor do you think the rather sudden withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and what happened after that with the Islamic State rise, what did that play in the calculations for this decision?
I wouldn't be surprised if senior officials consulting or advising the president brought that up. I mean, we did learn our lesson with what happened in Iraq. In Afghanistan, I think the situation is considerably different. The main issue that was less so the case in Iraq is actually that the Afghan National Security Forces might not have the capability to continue the fight against the Taliban. There are issues like budgetary shortfalls. The Afghan government has had a hard time making payroll payments for public sector employees, and it's encountering attrition and losses in the military, and there are doubts about its ability to continue that fight. So I think that, more so than the concern of some sort of sectarian meltdown like we saw in Iraq, probably drove the president's calculus.
A defense policy analyst at the Center for American Progress here in Washington said the announcement would allow the U.S. to keep key bases open in Taliban-active areas like Jalalabad and Kandahar. And, of course, you have the traditional spring-summer offensive dry season coming up in Afghanistan.
They are very close to the areas where the Taliban operates. They're close to the Pakistani border, additionally. Those bases being open and allowing the United States to operate troops out of there will be significant in counterterrorism operations of making sure that the Taliban is effectively suppressed.
But this is, of course, a short-term reprieve. The president indicated he intends to hold fast to a pledge to withdraw almost all U.S. troops by 2017 when he is set to leave office. Does this give Afghanistan some breathing space?
It does give Afghanistan some breathing space. It gives the Ghani administration some breathing space. As far as President Obama is concerned, I think, you know, he wants to be the president that ends the war in Afghanistan. He wants that to be a part of his legacy. So I think we will see him work hard to make that goal a reality. I think the 2017 deadline now is realistic. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be a complete withdrawal. Advisors will stay back, train. I believe a few troops will stay back for training purposes as well. But, you know, I think he really wants that to be a part of his legacy, and we'll see it happen, I think.
Ankit Panda, editor of The Diplomat. ISIS is credited with wisely using social media to recruit new members through its propaganda online. Brookings Foreign Policy calls its activities sophisticated and effective. J.M. Berger, a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, has been researching how ISIS uses social media.
They use it for a variety of purposes. The most visible one is to spread their propaganda. They have a lot of content, video and audio, texts that they want to send out to the widest possible audience. And then beyond that, they also use it for recruiting. They reach out to people directly. They use it for fundraising to a certain extent.
What sort of social media do they use?
Everything that's available. They're very aggressive. They're on pretty much every platform except MySpace, anywhere they can find users. So Tumblr, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, most notoriously.
How do they use Twitter?
They use Twitter in a very systematic way. So they have, a couple of thousand accounts that are really run by users whose job it is to do nothing but tweet all day. So they tweet at a very high volume, and that allows them to manipulate the system, although since Twitter has started suspending accounts, it's harder for them to do that.
Who are these people who are so sophisticated with social media?
You know, they've recruited a lot of technical people in a very systematic way. They look for hackers. They look for people who are familiar with social media. We have heard from the FBI that American might be involved in this process. We're not sure how important he is in the hierarchy of who runs this thing, but it is, we are pretty sure that he is involved in their social media plan.
And the amazing thing about the social media and Twitter is that you can be anywhere in the world. You could have people in the United States and some in Africa and some in the Middle East, and they can all communicate immediately.
Yes. I mean, in a lot of ways, what they do is very similar to the kind of recruitment that extremist groups have always done. But they're able to do it over a much broader distance. So, I mean, you know, back in the 1980s and the 1990s, people watched videos that supported terrorism in the similar kinds of videos to what we see now. There are videos of military action, and there are videos that exhort people to take up arms, but, you know, they had to go somewhere to do it, or they had to, you know, somebody would give you a VCR tape that you would take home and watch.
Well, we can't counter a lot of things that happen on the Internet, even here in the United States. Is there any way to counter this effort by ISIS?
There are things we can do. I mean, the most kind of easiest thing to do, which is already happening now, is that these accounts can be suspended when they break the rules of the platform that they're on. So in the case of Facebook and YouTube, they have specific rules that, you know, prohibit support for terrorism. In the case of Twitter, they have a rule that prohibits direct specific threats and violence, and it's a considerably broader kind of category for what gets you suspended from the platform. You know, so, I mean, when it's, that's kind of the easiest thing to do, is when they break the rules, we throw them off. And then, you know, beyond that, they can be targeted more specifically on these networks. And that's a little bit touchier kind of a debate, and it's, there's some pros and cons to consider, but certainly, you know, what we've seen since Twitter really started suspending these guys in September is that the function of the network has really declined. They're really not doing as well as they used to.
Well, after this work you've done on this study, this extensive study, what are your conclusions about all this?
The most obvious conclusion we saw was that the suspensions were having some effect. You know, when we go beyond that, you know, it was also obvious that there was great intelligence value to be extracted from this. We were able to see locations. You know, I loaded all of these accounts up into a Twitter client and read them over time. And, you know, there's just an incredible amount of information, a lot of uses that could be put to. I think ultimately, you know, there's been a debate about these suspensions that it's kind of all or nothing. People say that, you know, we should suspend all of these accounts aggressively, or they say, you know, we shouldn't do anything because it's all pointless, because it doesn't have any effect. And I think neither of those things is true. I think you can go down the middle, and you can say, you know, we can hurt the way this network performs and still leave enough accounts up that we can get intelligence value out of it.
J.M. Berger, co-author of the study, Defining and Describing the Population of ISIS Supports on Twitter, also called ISIS, the State of Terror. He is also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. An analysis of the transition to democracy in various countries shows that civil society groups are playing a crucial role in building and sustaining democratic institutions. This phenomenon was particularly noticeable in the Middle East and North Africa during the uprisings known collectively as the Arab Spring. In Egypt, critics of both post-revolution governments argue that neither has done enough to foster the transition to a more law-based society. They say under both the Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, and now under President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Egypt has sought to shut down citizen engagement through arrests, trials, and legal restrictions. The Washington-based Project on Middle East Democracy, or POMED, has released a report titled Egypt's Systematic Campaign Against Civil Society. POMED's advocacy associate, Todd Ruffner, spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the campaign's impact on Egypt's transition to democracy.
Egypt's January 2011 revolution brought with it a hope that the nation's civil society would be able to work free of oppression, intimidation, and harassment for the first time in history. How did such hope dash over the past 4 years?
Well, I think what we found in our, you know, sort of in our observations and in our conversations is that every successive Egyptian government has made efforts to tamp down on Egyptian civil society. It sees it, you know, as one of its primary threats to sort of draw attention to, you know, their misgivings, whether that be, you know, the history of the Mubarak regime and then the SCAF and then the Morsi government and now Sisi. Each successive government has targeted civil society and the NGO community in particular as it sees it as a threat to its rule. So there's really been a trend of just different, a lot of different but also very similar methods to undermine their work and to prevent their work in a lot of ways. So it's really been a pretty consistent campaign by every government.
So what are the primary methods used by the Egyptian authorities to restrict the ability of NGOs to complete their work?
We identified five different ways that they work to try to undermine the projects of these organizations. The first is sort of restricting authorization to work or registration. The second is restricting funding from abroad and within Egypt. The third is direct government oversight into sort of day-to-day operations. The last two are less legalistic and more sort of coercive, the first of which is sort of the coercive methods, whether that be harassment or death threats, violence, raids, those sort of things. And the last is a sustained campaign of defamation against these groups to sort of tie them to foreign plots or to say that they're undermining the security of Egypt. So those are the five main strategies that we identified to undermine the work.
So how will NGOs in Egypt be able to continue to play a meaningful role in the country's future?
That's a good question. I'm we're not necessarily sure about how they're going to, you know, find space to operate. But the people that we talked to, few dozen different NGO workers, and each had a different answer. Some are sort of shying away from sensitive topics, sensitive projects, so they don't draw attention. Others are stopping their work altogether. Some are finding ways to lie low for a while until they feel like things are safe. But I don't think there's any way right now for the NGO community to continue to operate as it has in the last couple of years. And we were talking to an NGO worker that we had in town this week, and he said the biggest difference, you know, over the last couple of years in the Sisi government is that the governments before Sisi really just tried to restrict the work and restrict these NGOs, and Sisi seems to be trying to eliminate them. And that's a really serious and different big distinction between that. And so I think that there's a question whether these groups are going to be able to continue to play a meaningful role in Egypt's future.
But we all know that NGOs play a pivotal role in transition toward democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Why the current government of Sisi is against this kind of role that would help to transform Egypt to a real democracy?
Well, first, I don't necessarily think this government is interested in any sort of democratic rule. I think they say that they are, but they very clearly, you know, in a number of different ways, not just with the NGO community, but in a number of different ways, taken actions that are very undemocratic and have proven that doesn't seem to be a priority for them. And as you said, civil society and NGOs do play a really important role in that transition. And from our view, you know, it would be important for these groups to be able to openly operate as Egypt is dealing with extremism, because these groups tend to help sort of provide alternative narratives and push back against extremism, which is a problem that Egypt is facing pretty seriously right now. So, you know, it definitely is key for any sort of meaningful and stable democratic transition, but I don't think the Egyptian government right now is particularly interested in that.
As momentum builds in Washington towards normalizing U.S. relations with the Egyptian state, what should the U.S. do to avoid repeating the same failed policy it adopted during Mubarak's era, overlooking domestic repression in return for stability?
Well, I think, you know, this is part of a larger conversation that, you know, the NGO community, you know, whether it's in Congress or the administration, has gotten a significant amount of attention, especially when, you know, American workers and American groups were under pressure in the last couple of years. And I think it really needs to be part, you know, of a larger strategy to make sure that, you know, we're not just overlooking, you know, this oppression, and that the stuff that Egypt wants, the Egyptian government wants right now, this, you know, sort of legitimacy from the international community, especially from the United States. If we're going to, you know, continue with that, we need to put pressure on them to, you know, not to continue this path, and to make sure that that's done both publicly and privately, and that we tie that to certain things, whether that be investments and future aid, and make it clear that a strong relationship with the United States is contingent upon satisfying some of these basic values that we hold, and some of these basic freedoms for the civil society. And I think that needs to be clear, and I think that needs to be considered by both the administration and by Congress as we move forward with our relationship with Egypt.
Project on Middle East Democracy Advocacy Associate Todd Ruffner. Search efforts continue at the site of a crash of a German Wings A320 Airbus on a flight from Barcelona to Dusseldorf in the French Alps. There were no survivors among the 150 people aboard. The cockpit voice recorder has been recovered and sent to Paris for analysis. Scott Hamilton, an aviation consultant with the Seattle, Washington-based Lehman Company, says it should reveal critical information on the final moments of the flight.
They'll look at mechanical problems. They'll look at pilot actions. They'll look at whether there might have been a criminal action involved. They'll look at all of that. But the cockpit voice recorder is the black box that I understand from news reports is the one that was recovered. If it wasn't too badly damaged and they can download the data, we may have some real answers in just a matter of a couple of days.
They already have data on the plane's descent.
The fact that it went from 38,000 feet down to point of impact, which is somewhere around 5,000, 6,000 feet. That's a descent rate of about 3,000 or 4,000 feet a minute. It looked like it was actually a controlled descent from the radar tracking. Didn't look like it was an emergency descent. The real intriguing part about this is the fact that there was no radio communication or no transponder communication to indicate any kind of an emergency. So you would think that had there been a cabin decompression, the descent would have been much more rapid. There would have been radio communication. If there was some sort of mechanical issue over the course of 8 minutes, you would have thought there would have been some sort of radio communication. And there wasn't. And that's the real intriguing part about this.
Hamilton says the Airbus A320 series is a global workhorse with over 11,000 built and more than 6,000 still in use since 1988. Authorities in Vanuatu are warning of imminent food and water shortages after the South Pacific nation was hit by a Category 5 Cyclone Pam on March 13th. 11 people are confirmed to have died in the tropical storm, and tens of thousands were left homeless. From the capital of Vanuatu, Port Vila, Phil Mercer reports.
Vanuatu's long-term recovery from Cyclone Pam will be discussed Wednesday at a meeting led by the United Nations in Port Vila. The UN has made an urgent appeal for $23 million to provide life-saving assistance, including food, water, healthcare, and shelter. Tens of thousands of people have been affected by the tropical storm. On the island of Nuna, village chief Donald Manamena says many residents have been left with nothing.
This is probably the worst cyclone that I have experienced and I have seen. I would say that this is the first cyclone of this climate change that much talk has been going around about. We will need outside help, water and food. People will need something to start rebuilding again. There's nothing on the land right now that people can earn money from.
Nuna is home to 1,000 people. Their main source of income, fruit and vegetables grown in rich volcanic soil, have been destroyed, along with many homes. John is a father of four who's trying to rebuild what was lost.
The cyclone hit my house about 10 o'clock. Iron roofing all off.
What about food and water? How much have you got and how long will it last for?
No more water now.
What do you worry about the most? Is it the fate of the house, food, water, or maybe the threat of disease here?
Yeah, I am worried about the sickness. All the children.
The United Nations says there's a significant risk of disease across Vanuatu due to water shortages, limited medical care, and poor sanitation. But despite the widespread problems, there is great resilience here, says one female villager.
At the meantime, we have to look after ourselves, our families, so we just be careful that nobody gets sick.
Australia and New Zealand have been at the forefront of the international aid efforts, while Britain and France, Vanuatu's former colonial rulers, have also been heavily involved. New Zealand High Commissioner Georgina Roberts praises the islanders' ability to help themselves in such dire circumstances.
The devastation is immense, but the ability of the people here to bounce back and to step forward and try and start picking up and clearing up is fantastic.
Vanuatu's Prime Minister Joe Natuman says it could take several years for the South Pacific island chain to fully recover from one of the most powerful cyclones the region has ever seen.
So right now, the shelter is very important. Shelter, water, medicine for people to start rebuilding their lives. And then we will start the reconstruction phase. So it will take years for us to recover.
The economy relies heavily on tourism and agriculture. Both sectors have been hard hit. But the authorities promise that although a paradise has been lost, Vanuatu, an archipelago that's home to more than 250,000 people, would eventually recover. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Vanuatu.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 25th, 1306, Robert the Bruce became King of Scotland. A famous warrior, Robert led Scottish forces in the wars for Scottish independence against England. He is still considered one of Scotland's national heroes. In 1655, Dutch mathematician and scientist Christian Huygens discovered Saturn's largest moon, Titan. In 1807, the Slave Trade Act became law, abolishing the slave trade in the British Empire. In 1901, the Daimler Motor Company of Germany built a car that took the automotive industry beyond the realm of the horseless carriage. Built for automobile dealer and racing enthusiast Emil Jelinek, the new owner asked Daimler to name the car after his daughter, Mercedes. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A prominent Zimbabwean journalist and pro-democracy activist snatched in broad daylight in a Harare suburb remains missing more than 2 weeks after his abduction. According to witnesses, Atai Dezimato was seized by five men while getting his hair cut March 9th and loaded into an unmarked truck. He hasn't been seen since, and authorities say they have no leads on his welfare or whereabouts. Mr. Dezimato heads the pro-democracy group Occupy Africa Unity Square that calls on President Robert Mugabe, holding power since 1987, to step down. The group takes its name from Africa Unity Square in the capital, the site of Zimbabwe's parliament and federal courts. He has pressed the demands in his writings, and 2 days before his kidnapping, he spoke at an opposition rally calling for mass protests against political and economic conditions in the Southern African nation. The United States joins the European Union, Canada, the United Kingdom, and international human rights groups in deep concern over Mr. Dezimato's disappearance. It is notable that the government of Zimbabwe officially acknowledged concern over what it called a barbaric act, and the United States prevails on the government of Zimbabwe to pursue action to resolve the case. The United States urges the Zimbabwean authorities to mobilize their full resources to locate Mr. Dezimato and investigate the circumstances surrounding his disappearance, as well as to ensure the protection of his human rights and fundamental freedoms. The United States stands with Mr. Dezimato and the people of Zimbabwe in defending the rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, and joins calls for Mr. Dezimato's immediate and safe return to his family and friends.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.